Good evening. Welcome. If you would like to take your seats up there, others still coming in. I think we have a treat in store. I've heard Homi Bhabha speak many times before, and I was thinking earlier how to describe to my students when I was encouraging them earlier to come the effect of a Homi Bhabha lecture. And I thought the best way of describing it is rather like going to a concert. I was actually slightly warning the students that they may not grasp the narrative immediately. So I said, you must think of it as a symphony, and watch out for the movement changes, listen for the underlying themes and the moments of repetition, and don't think till the very end. You're at a position to grasp the totality. So I think that's a reasonable way of describing what is to come. But I want to first of all spend a very brief moment introducing our distinguished guest, Homi Bhabha, to you. I think the best way of introducing him is through a very personal story. Some years ago, I was invited for dinner at Richard Sennett's house. Actually, it's a wonderful flat, and we among the dinner's guests at dinner was Homi and his wife. The dinner started at about 9 o'clock. We all sat down, and after about 2 or 3 minutes, I put my usual enlightenment feet first, and some remark came up about conflict of human rights in the Niger Delta, and I went straight in there, you know, on behalf of a human rights agenda, the underlying enlightenment principles that support and so on, most things that my students hear a lot of on a routine basis. Homi looked at me and just looked more and more puzzled, and then he said, "But my dear David, there are other considerations." It was about 9:12 when the "But my dear David" started. I'd never met Homi before. And I left, I think I left the dinner party at about 3:15 in the morning. I had the most extraordinary discussion of my life. It wasn't just the best dinner party I'd ever been to. It was the best academic discussion I have ever had. And it was about the Enlightenment, the meaning of the Enlightenment today, the durability, the legacy of Enlightenment principles, the meaning of Enlightenment principles in the context of different cultures, traditions, intertextuality, interdiscourse, connections, and so on. And I was shaking when I left. But I wasn't shaking with rage. I was shaking just because of sheer adrenaline that pumped through this six-hour argument. And anyway, I always thought other people went to dinner parties and had six-hour arguments, and I never had one. So it felt like an astonishing and defining moment. And since that moment, Homi Bhabha and I have been close friends, dialogue partners, and have disputed in a number of interesting different sorts of places. But more formally, Homi Bhabha was born in Mumbai, India. His family is of the Parsi minority, a minority which just has 160,000 members worldwide. He went to Mumbai University, where he got his first degree, then to Oxford for a master's and a doctorate. He's been a senior fellow at numerous institutions, Princeton, Pennsylvania, Chicago, and he is today at that quite well-known university, Harvard, where he is the Anne F. Rothenberg Professor of English and American Literature and Chair of the Program in History and Literature at that distinguished institution. He is one of the leading voices today in what has been called post-colonial theory. His work is heavily influenced by post-structuralism. He's been influenced by Derrida, Lacan, Foucault, and others. You'll have to explain to us social scientists later who these people are. But he's not just been influenced, he has shaped and reshaped these traditions, adding his own distinctive philosophical, theoretical, cultural, literary voice. Homi has written a number of books. He has written Nation and Narration, The Location of Culture, and is working on a very intriguing title at the moment, A Global Measure, which I understand explores the cultural, ethical, and aesthetic claims that accompany the desire for global progress in an intercultural context. His lecture tonight, Global Visions, it was postponed from last year. It was part of our Miliband series of Culture in the Age of Global Communications. In this case, it's not a case of better late than never, but better excellent if late. Thank you very much, Homi, and join with me welcoming him.
David, thank you for that very generous and warm and delicious introduction. Amongst my people, once you have eaten salt at somebody's table, you have forever to hold your tongue and speak only the economical version of the truth. Not having yet supped, as we will do later tonight with David Held, at his table, let me just say that both David's friendship over the years, his collaboration as a dialogist and a conversational partner in various stimulating environments, and his work have been enormously important for me. He characterized himself, mischaracterized himself as this statue of liberty of the Enlightenment age. He is, of course, deeply questioning within that tradition and makes it possible for those like me who experience that other Enlightenment, colonization, to enter into a full and free discussion. David, thank you very much. I'm honored today to be giving the Miliband lecture, and of course, to stand under that title and that name is an enormous responsibility, but also something to live up to. So I thank you for having me here today. I also want to thank Aisha Kaya, who has done a huge amount to make this possible. Aisha, thank you very much.
I think we should give Aisha an applause. She wants you to go on.
With your permission, Aisha, then I shall continue. David is, I suppose, right. He asked me a minute ago, just before he stepped up here, he said, you know, do you compare your talks to string quartets or orchestral performances? And he's, you know, it's a very good question. And I suppose I have to say, with my penchant for hybridity, that today it's going to be something in between. Because the very nature of what I want to explore is something that has come to fascinate me increasingly, but something that's actually very difficult, I found very difficult to write about. It started when I first started working on Fanon, and I found a line in Black Skin, White Masks which said, everything here is to do with temporality. Not to do with history, but everything here is to do with temporality. And that set me off to try and think of the difference between temporality and history, philosophically, and also textually. I've become very interested in posing a certain kind of thought to myself and to the work I do, which is, how would you discover, how would you discuss, how would you represent, how would you make decisions about a temporality that was transitional rather than transformational? One where the teleology was bracketed away, how it would work out was somehow staunched, where you felt, as indeed one feels with popular political discourse today, when people like George Bush and others say, we don't know when this war will end, and yet you have to give us this this amount of money, or yet you have to do this, or yet your rights will deteriorate. But we don't know. We don't know. And people get elected on saying, we don't know what this moment is. We don't know the configuration. So I'm very interested in the temporalities of transition without the promise of transformation. Or at least if there is a promise of transformation, it's at the level of a seed. It's there and you don't know how it's going to grow. So this talk then is about that problem. In various discourses about globalization, it is about contingency and what one does with the contingent and why the contingent might be important. Now, of course, you might say there are always moments of contingency. It's what you do with it that is important. And I've tried to provide you with some views of what happens when people feel that the foundational temporal even historical paradigm of their moments is some kind of contingent structure. This is why, or this is to say merely that I will fully live up to my reputation for being obscure, incomprehensible, and just treat this like Stockhausen or Schoenberg or something of that. Again, when you deal with issues of contingency, you do deal with this whole question of how do I assemble the parts? What parts do I put together? Wittgenstein, of course, writes about this. Freud, in a different way, writes about this, the provisionality of the parts that you assemble. But in fact, if you read Edward Said's last book on humanism and democratic criticism, it's all about how do I attach one part of my argument to the other? How do I attach one part of my diasporic community to the other? Indeed, the phrase that repeats the leitmotif of that book is that the humanist's and the philologist's duty is to continually think, what do I put with what? That's the kind of question I'm interested in. And that's why I'm going to try and assemble for you, in a kind of performance of transitional criticism, a range of global visions. Let me start with precisely such a statement, because where you have contingency, you have the threat of disjunctions, various kinds of fissiparous contradictions. And this is one about globalization with which I want to start, from Michel Foucault, from a wonderful and I think rather unread essay called For an Ethic of Discomfort, written in 1979. And Foucault says, we are witnessing a globalization of the economy, for certain. A globalization of political calculations, without doubt. But a universalization of political consciousness, certainly not. Now, David has been doing a lot, as you know, to try and create that universalization of political consciousness. But even he would agree that it's early days. It's this kind of problem that I'm interested in dealing with. In every decade, there are events that transcend their times and others that merely survive their histories. A defining image of the global world picture appeared on our television and computer screens on September 11, 2001, and there seemed to be a kind of consensus that the new millennium had come of age that morning. Coming of age is a curious phrase to describe a moment in life in which adolescence and adulthood grapple uncomfortably on the threshold of history, claiming the key to the door. But the door of history is neither open nor closed. The future lies on one side of the threshold. On the other commences the corridor to the past. And the present is a kind of interstitial frame that gives place and shape to the transition of times, the past and the present, or back to the future. I always believed that Terminus, the Roman deity of borders and frontiers who regulated the flows of arrivals and departures, the circulation of peoples and things, I always believed that Terminus was the god of globalization. It was in that spirit that I had chosen, indeed, to begin this talk, until I came upon a headline in the International Herald Tribune, November 15th, that read, U.S. seeks God's eye view of warfare. A report on the global information grid, GIG, essential for waging net-centric warfare, quoted Donald Rumsfeld, amongst others, who said that GIG would not be a weapon system, but a set of interconnections, networks and flows, repeating the discourse that we use in global terms, through which every member of the military would have a picture of the battle space, a God's eye view. This would allow, and I quote, for a fast and ferocious engagement with a faceless foe. It is this image of a global world picture
seen from the perspective of God, confronting a faceless human being, frozen in time and fixed in place, that provokes me to ask, what kind of temporal event is globalization? What sense of time and being courses through its complex capillaries of spatial diffusions and dispersals? The sense of transition that I'm trying to derive from the coming of age narrative, the door of history, these juxtapositions of the old and the new, past and present, focuses and fuzzinesses, design and detail, are everywhere evident in the global world picture today. In our attempt to define the age of the world picture, if I might call it that, we should heed Heidegger's warning in that great essay, which The Age of the World Picture, which I think is one of the great unread texts of many of the discourses of globalization, Age of the World Picture. We should heed Heidegger's warning that the measure of the world as representation, as image, as photograph, as news report, as literature, cannot be grasped in the language of giganticism or its opposite, the increasingly small. We do not think at all, he says, if we believe we have explained this phenomenon of the gigantic with the catchword Americanism. The measure of globality lies then in the shadow of what he calls incalculability that is cast when the invisible shadow is cast around all things everywhere, when man has been transformed into subjectum and the world into picture. Now, of course, the Americanism that he's talking about was the great fear in Germany about American suburbanization, American cultural influence at that period. You know, in Weimar, there were a number of people. The film theorist Krakauer wrote a lot about this invasion of Americanism. And in fact, there was in the earlier part of the century a very interesting moment, happened in India too, that whenever certain kind of normative ethical aspects of one's community were changed through technology, it was often known and called Americanism. Americanism was the name of that fear. Very different fear, of course, from Gig. Is this notion of the incalculable anything more than the obscurantism of the philosopher, the kind of thing that appeals to me, or the opiate of the literary theorist? Heidegger's prescient statement, made in 1938, a kind of critique of the global and the local as a way of measuring giganticism or the world, certainly touches the nerve of our times. The language of the local and the global, alongside its various mutations and hybrids, such as the translocal, is a kind of foundational distinction that dominates the spatial language of the global discourse. In many ways, Heidegger's statement sums up both the dilemma and the dynamic of my talk today. I'm less concerned with the global as a given epistemological object of economic knowledge or historical knowledge and description, and more with the productive interactions, call them articulations, enunciations, discourse, between representations of the global vision, the world turned into picture or text or sculpture or painting, and the intervention or interlocution of the human subject, reader, critic, political or ethical being, agent, at the point at which she or he comes to be identified as a global spectator, a global citizen, an interpreter. Global incalculability is produced then in the here and now, in an effect of the here, in a representational effect of the here and now, of this relational process by which we create the life worlds, the images, or the text messages of the global condition and its covenants. It is not as if globalization does not exist out there in NGOs or indeed in real life situations such as factories. It does. It's not that it doesn't exist out there. It manifestly does. But it exists in Hannah Arendt's wonderfully canny sense of the ethical and political poesis, the poesis of social and cultural life. Of course, globalization exists, but it all depends on what you make of it. It is not as if there is a dearth of global information. It is not as if we lack global indices, and we certainly possess definitions of globalization that are exemplary in their precision and their excellence. As indeed is this one by David Held et al. In Global Transformations. And I quote, there's a lot of David here, so you can laugh embarrassedly every now and then.
Take it or leave it.
Globalization, they write in Global Transformation, implies that connections across frontiers are regularized such that there is a detectable intensification or growing magnitude of interconnectedness, patterns of interaction, and flows which transcend the constituent societies and states of the world order. There is a deepening enmeshment of the local and the global, such that the impact of distant events is magnified, while even the most local developments may come to have enormous global consequences. In the face of such intelligibility and clarity, where is this shadow, this constitutive shadow of the Heideggerian incalculability? This is very clear. Why do we need this shadow? What is this shadow when we talk about the immense? What is this shadow that creeps into our language of representation, into our language of judgment, which makes, in many discourses, people say, the legal discourse on global citizenship, which I'm very, people make all kinds of proposals, and then they say, finally, this is an immeasurable discourse. Finally, we're at the point of aspiration. There's always this thing that returns in the language of globalization. It's somehow immeasurable. It's huge. It's ungraspable. And that's, you know, what I'm trying to think about today. The incalculable does not, in that definition, in that wonderful definition, immediately occur at the epistemological or definitional level. The level which is often supported by graphs and referenced by visual charts and projections. It occurs at the point at which the language of description rather than definition is mediated by a kind of metaphoricity, a displacement, or in a positive sense, a distortion of the mimetic level of the definition. It occurs when the specificity of the global process is described as a kind of movement, a kind of speed, as intensification, magnification, enmeshment, as a kind of temporality. At that point, the argument imagines a metaphorized and mediated subjectum. It need not be an individual person, nor indeed a subjectum need not be a subjective process. It could be a perspectival position, an invitation to read, to interpret, a place of agency, a dialogic address, a moment of a certain kind of self-reflexive consciousness of the whole process. So it's as if these metaphors hover above the definition. They're there. They're kind of temporal markers, and to use your musical analogy, it's like the time sign beside the graph. They designate disjunctive, even erratic movements and temporalities. What is enlarged in one place becomes mundane in another. What is slow suddenly turns fast. It is this contingency that is incalculable. And I want to argue that it is very much part of the whole construction of the discourse, and it cannot be represented in graphs, even if those graphs show a kind of intensification or of forces at one point. I think this is a different problem of the mimetic in the description and the measurement of the global. It is this contingency that is incalculable. And I want to argue that it is through a historically and temporally constituted contingency that the global subject is represented and identified and participates in the world picture. The task now is to specify what is peculiar about the effects and affects of global contingency as a condition of enlargement. Now, let me say for a moment that how I think in the definition that David and his colleagues gave us, how this dialectic of incalculability works. Because it has a double movement, a palimpsestical side-by-side movement rather than a binary or polarized dynamic that has, you know, been normalized by the global discourse through variants of the local and the global. On the one hand, the material transformation of globalization are signified in the language of enlargement or magnification. Interactions, interconnections, the community grows larger, the object, and flows that transcend constituent states and societies. On the other, there is a movement towards enmeshment, blurring, space-time compression, action at a distance. I'm using all these keywords most commonly used in the discourse of globalization and used across the social sciences, as far as I can tell, even in the law. And these words, this second tension, this second movement, are the words usually associated with the velocity of the global. When enlargement and magnification intersect and interact with each other in the global discourse, we do not get a totalized map of knowledge or a unified global world picture. At this point of intersection, I will argue, we feel, and I quote, an irresistible urge to search such a global picture for a tiny spark of contingency of the here and now with which reality has, so to speak, seared the subject or the agent to find the inconspicuous spot where the future rests so eloquently that we may rediscover it. I'm suggesting it's in this moment of contingency that many of the issues of culture, the imagination, ethicality, it's at that metaphorical level, that level of what I've called metaphoric description rather than definition, that a subject is put in place which has those various responses, the ethical, the domain of the imaginative. Now, the passage I just read to you, which many of you probably know, does not come from me, except that I have shamelessly interpolated and adapted it, but it comes from Walter Benjamin's Meditation on the Philosophical and Temporal Consequences of the Photographic Process of Enlargement and How It Changes the World Picture of Modernity. It comes from his essay on photography, where he's again interested in, just as we're interested in the enlargement of globalization as a kind of self-reflective or a self-reflexive moment, he's very interested in how enlargement, the very nature of photographic enlargement, which was also a technological invention of velocity, it changed the whole world picture of modernity, how people could see themselves through the process of enlargement. Benjamin's belief, and again with Benjamin, I want to say that one of the interesting things about the process of enlargement, and I think that the work of Benjamin is so important for students of cultural globalization, particularly the Arcades project, because he does, as he says, treat Paris as the capital of the world, the way he talks about commodification, or indeed now about the mimesis of enlargement, or how you deal with larger things that keep changing their form, their phenomenological and political forms. And again, with Benjamin, the idea is not that modernity is in the picture or out of the picture. He says by enlarging it, you change your whole value system and you change your perspectival system. Benjamin's belief in the inventions and uses of technology as the motor and symptom of the historical transformation of modernity makes him enormously relevant to our own global reflections today on the ethics and the aesthetics of global communications and techno-science. What I want to develop is an argument about the relationship between time and the seared subject or agent of the global experience. How should we, who live with the asymmetries and disjunctions of the global world picture, who inhabit its here and now, relate to the historical contingencies that shape our identities, our imaginations, and our communities? Now, this is perhaps too general a question, but I have set myself the task of relating it to a range of genres, texts, and historical moments which might speak to different parts of the audience today. My critical emphasis is on the narrative, temporal, and cultural structures of global discourse, and I will start by discussing these issues in the context of postmodern global cultural studies. I will then move on to explore various visions of global community. Gramsci's cultural front, constructed in terms of what he calls a philosophy of the part, a partial philosophy, something like the translocal or a philosophy of the part. David Held's overlapping communities of fate. Then I moved to poetry, to a wonderful poem. If you want to leave, don't leave till I read the poem. Adrienne Rich's unsatisfied ethical global community. And finally, I will end with a brief look at Edward Said's contrapuntal humanist cosmopolitanism. The link between these visions, of course, is mine. It's by their ability to constitute a transformative sense of global consciousness and agency built around what I have been trying to describe as this transitional phase, this spark of contingency that is a significant part of the here and now of global thinking and global living. There is I would just like to say that this, in my reading, when global theory deals with this here and now, enlarged, magnified, change of speeds, change of time, shift the gear, it's very different, or it's quite different than what Habermas talks about when he talks about the exaltation of the present, a presentism in classical modernism and classical modernity. I just want to mark that difference. So I'm not talking about a presentism. I am talking about the metaphor I started with, of the door of history, the grapple at the threshold, the corridors of past and present. I think that global theorists are, even if they don't actually develop conceptually and philosophically and in terms of narrative or aesthetics or ethics, this conjunction of times, they're much more aware of it. It just seems to me that sometimes the language of the social sciences irons it out and treats it in a much more instrumental way, whereas I'm trying to emphasize today its material, imaginative, creative, philosophical aspects. There is an influential postmodern view that the language of measure is now obsolete because contingency is everywhere, quite unsuited to the immeasurable nature of global geopolitical relations. Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, who I greatly admire, boldly declare that in the globality of biopower, every fixed measure of value tends to be dissolved, and the imperial horizon of power is revealed finally to be a horizon outside measure. When cultural critics argue with increasing regularity that postmodernism is the logic of global capital, to use the title of a very well-known essay, or that, and I quote, the world market establishes a real politics of difference, they seem to turn the world into a metaphor of mondialisation in which the persistence of national or international governance is wrongly seen as the remnant of an archaic or atavistic force. It's not as if globalization produces new forms of nationhood and new forms of globalization. It's as if somehow this is a leftover thing that is, you know, flogging its life. Such arguments work through analogy by equating the conceptual language of cultural studies with select aspects of the global political economy. Commodification, financial flows, capital transfers, outsourcing, and flexible accumulation is exactly what my confreres, my colleagues in cultural studies, often use. These are the parts of the economy that they will always talk about. I kept asking myself, you know, why? Why do they pick on these particular aspects of the global economy? Well, these economic and financial processes, it seems to me, resonate with the semiotic vocabularies of cultural studies. It's what they know. The circulation of commodities, the opening up of free trade zones, the flow of financial or communicational transfers are identified with the circulation of images, the exchange of cultural signs, the excess of signification, the intertextual transfers of meaning. The elements of the global economy and polity that can be read under the sign of semiotic circulation or deterritorialization are then mobilized for a wider political and ethical argument that suggests that the goal of citizenship lies, Hart and Negri again write, and I quote, in the struggle against the slavery of belonging to a nation, an identity, and a people, and thus the desertion from sovereignty and the limits it places on subjectivity is entirely positive. Nomadism and miscegenation appear here as figures of virtue, the first ethical practices on the terrain of what they themselves endorse and call empire. And end of quote. Now, such an emancipatory ideal, so affixed on the flowing, borderless worlds, neglects to confront the fact that migrants, refugees, and nomads, thank God for it, don't merely circulate. They need to settle, claim asylum, or nationality, demand housing and education, assert their economic and cultural rights, and seek the status of citizenship. It is salutary, then, to turn to less circulatory forms of the economy, like trades and tariffs, or taxes and monetary policy, which are much less open to this kind of postmodern metaphoric or analogical appropriation. I've written some other stuff about taxation. The global cunning of world markets must not be underestimated, nor, however, should the world's trade zones be celebrated as a bricolage of borderless bazaars. At a rough estimate, almost 90% of all worldwide trade policies and tariffs are still controlled by nation states rather than interregional bodies. The European Union and Mercosur are exceptions to this global trend, setting their tariffs according to customs union regulations, but this represents only a modest variation in the persistence of trade barriers across the world. And yet taxation or trade tariffs are no less a matter of concern for cultural globalization, which places explicitly the problem of migration and the accelerated movements of peoples and things at the heart of a new global polity. Indeed, to the extent to which global equality and justice demands the free flow of peoples and goods, then properly levied redistributive taxes, global or otherwise, have, I would have thought, a crucial role to play in providing migrants and the poor with social welfare, public goods, medical care, and educational benefits. Barely was the ink of the printer dry on the page after I wrote this that I was flying to Los Angeles and read the LA Times, which had on its front cover that nobody in America wants to pay their taxes except for the migrant populations, the immigrant populations of Chinatowns, who are dying to pay their taxes. I should have brought it with me. It's in my bag. They're dying to pay their taxes. They're this jubilant look on their faces saying, you know, please accept my tax form, then I will be represented. And the lawyers in China said, we've never seen anything. Why do these people want to? Is there something about the Chinese that they want to pay taxes? Of course, there's also some wonderful work, really, and this is why I think cultural studies aficionados should work with taxation, because taxation is representation in both senses of the term. There's wonderful work by feminist historians about taxation, for instance, in 18th century Philadelphia, where lots of women had small businesses, but the state would not accept them as taxpayers because then they would have to recognize them as quasi-citizens. They would have to recognize their political presence. So I think, you know, this is a call for any of you. I don't know how many there are here who work in the loony field I work in called cultural studies, but work on taxation. I've actually done some work, and I'm trying to do some work on, say, the Tobin tax, its problems and its failures, but also its ethical import. Suggestions that the very idea of a national economy is becoming meaningless, or that the world market is liberated from the kind of binary division that nation states has imposed, show a poor understanding what it means to live in what I've been calling a moment of transition or contingency or the spark of the here and now, that particular kind of global transitionality. How should we understand such a moment? Such a moment, Gramsci suggests, is transitional because it is a moment of historical incubation rather than the inauguration of an era. The historically new, he says, is always a moment of incubation. What exists at any given time in the name of the new, and we should think about this because people talk about the new economy and the new globality. And the, what is the new, Gramsci says, is a variable combination of old and new, a momentary equilibrium of cultural relations. I hope what I mean by the contingent and the transition. A momentary equilibrium of various cultural, psychic, social relations. As we inhabit multiple non-coordinating jurisdictions today, phrase comes from Larry Lessig, who writes on the net, both materially and metaphorically, how do we articulate agency or collective consciousness? It is with these questions in mind that I want to turn to Gramsci's scattered speculations on what it means to create a cultural front engaged in what he calls ethico-political projects. A cultural front, he says, isn't necessarily a political party. It is more a movement or alliance of groups whose struggles for fairness and justice emphasize, he says, the collaboration between aesthetics, ethics, and activism. Actually, when Gramsci talks about the ethical political as a formation of peoples, and this is what I'm now trying to get into, when if you deal with this notion of contingency and the problem of measure, how can you build a political community? Many of his speculations are in his work on grammar, on linguistic grammar. He saw grammar as a way of thinking about how you put the bits and pieces together, the parts, which need not be the whole, but are effective because they're added one to the other. Now, we always think that adding one thing to another has to add up into a kind of organic or evolutionary whole. Gramsci, when he's talking precisely about this ethico-political front, which is not his much more common notion of the subaltern, and I think a much more interesting one for our moment, he is aware of the fact that it is a kind of political formation that happens when people recognize this contingency, this incubationality of time and history. It is a movement of alliance of groups whose struggles for fairness and justice emphasize the collaboration between ethics, aesthetics, and activism. A cultural front does not have a homogenous or totalizing view of the world, nor is it completely directed against the state. It may be oriented or cathected around one point of political or psychic identification between individual aspirations or group interests that turn into a mutual solidarity that represents a new tie in the uncertain circumstances of temporal incubation. In a significant work on the institutional culture of global human rights activists, Catherine Sicking points to what she calls principal issue networks that consist very much in the Gramscian sense of various agents, individuals, NGOs, some state agencies, that bring people together, focus on particular goals, organized around a particular issue of principle. The point at which the tie is formed between groups and within them must not be reduced to a model of common or universal subjectivity, because it is not the restoration of some original group identity or a neutralization of differences in the equality of rights. It is, to use a marvelous phrase by Balibar, it is about the diversification of freedoms, not of the universality. It's about learning how the diversification of freedoms can actually coexist. The cultural front creates its solidarity and agency by identifying with the contingent movement of the here and now, what Gramsci calls a momentary equilibrium, a mode of linkage made possible by what Gramsci has also described, and I've sort of put Gramsci together from bits and pieces, I have to say. So this is as much my Gramsci, more than his. Made possible by what Gramsci describes as the, and I quote, as the philosophy of the part that always precedes the philosophy of the whole, not only as its theoretical anticipation, but as a necessity of real life. Here again is the theme that I'm so interested in. You know, we have to think about transition not because we may not be able to anticipate what the whole is, but the necessity of life does not give us that whole, and we have to work with that sense of transition too. Gramsci's cultural front, albeit a species of what he called the subaltern, is, I believe, a manifestation of the philosophy of the part as a necessity of political and ethical life. The subaltern strategy of counter-hegemonic power, this strategy of the cultural front, is replete with nuances of the partial and the incipient in the process of global transformation and transition. The cultural front is deprived, he says, of historical dominance and initiative. It is often in a state of continuous but disorganic expansion, and more important for our particular kind of moments of global cultural and political and ethical fronts, it has to work, Gramsci suggests, at a certain qualitative level, which remains below or at an oblique angle to or side by side with or in the interstices of the level of the possessions of the state. Such a partial or interstitial identification is empowered to confront the ideological sway and sovereignty of the state's authority from the perspective of a progressive global cosmopolitanism, such as represented in human rights law or international criminal courts. These partial spaces, these spaces of the necessity of the philosophy of the part, these interstitial strategies that exist in between national interests and cosmopolitan commitments are not political ideals of another age, David Helders effectively argued, but embedded in rule systems and institutions that represent forms of governance diffused below, above, and alongside the nation state, end of quote. Gramsci's philosophy of the part is, I believe, informed, even in its own time, by a global philology. Let me quote. Historical grammar, he says, cannot but be comparative. An expression that analyzed thoroughly indicates the deep-seated awareness that the linguistic fact, like any other singular or partial historical fact, cannot have strictly defined national boundaries, but that history is always world history, and that particular histories exist only in the frame of world histories. And by frame, I don't think Gramsci simply means a kind of inclusive frame. I think he's using the word frame much more in terms of grammar, in much more in terms of the way in which signs constitute a signifying whole. Becoming global is in some respects, of course, still an aleatory claim rather than an achieved historical condition. It is a domain of potential, as Amartya Sen has elaborated in his book Development as Freedom. And what that is that it attaches as much intrinsic importance to prior ethical entitlements as it does to actual legal or institutional rights. And it is for this reason, I believe, that in addition to a global philology, the philosophy of the part, Gramsci's work with the contingent achieves also and proposes an ethical pedagogy. Quote, one should stress the importance and significance which, in the modern world, political parties have in the elaboration and the diffusion of the conceptions of the world, because, essentially, what these imaginative and aesthetic diffusions work out is the ethics and the politics corresponding to these conceptions and act, as it were, as their historical laboratory. Take a deep breath. The theoretical part of the talk is over. I hope you got. I hope it was like a kind of well-integrated Schubert symphony rather than Stockhausen. Now I shall take you into the historical laboratory and give you some glimpses of what I think the case I've made about contingency and how it works out through various concepts and thinkers. Such a cosmopolitan vision of the democratic citizenry of the future has been compellingly described by David Held as the condition of overlapping communities of fate. Political communities today, he writes, are locked into a diversity of processes and structures which range in and through them, linking and fragmenting them into complex constellations. If the agent at the heart of modern political discourse, be it a person, group, or government, is locked into a variety of overlapping communities and jurisdictions, then the proper home of politics and democracy becomes difficult to resolve. That's David. The linkage through fragmentation, through what I've been calling the philosophy of the part, the contingent, and I'm now going to try and respond and elaborate this difficulty of resolve. Creating effective global links through fragmentation give rise to translocal solidarities and transborder movements. The proper home of global democratic politics is that deterritorialized space of human rights and legal and cultural representations that transgresses the dominating domestic boundaries of the reasons of state. At that point, then, the philosophy of the part makes a link with the wider ethical and political diffusion of conceptions of the world. The harder problem by far relates to the what, to use David's phrase, the proper home of the active agent. Her ethical-political obligation to what David calls and sees as fundamental to the cosmopolitical view, which is to see reason from the point of view of others. So the agent's ethical and political obligations to seeing reason, putting herself in the at the place of thinking reasons from the point of view of others, quite properly commits us, Held argues, to a global internationalism, and this is a very interesting proposal of his, that must take as its starting point, from the most brutal phases of history in order to create a resilient, representative, and equitable political and cultural community. I particularly appreciate this point, which is made at the end of Global Covenant, I think in the last paragraph. If you're going to reconstruct a cosmopolitical history, you've got to take, and you've got to understand your own history at the level of its most alienating, self-questioning moments. Now, this is actually a rather different view from a debate between Charles Taylor and myself. He's written The Politics of Recognition, he says when you judge a culture, you have to judge the main historical trends of it, not the partial milieu. And in the Amnesty lecture I gave at Oxford, I took the position of the partial milieu, the moments when a culture acts most untypically. It's savagery, contradictions, it's betrayals. I said, you know, if you have to take those partial milieu, you know, given my sort of psychoanalytic interests, and see them symptomatically. What do they come? I mean, this is the Adorno argument again. And, you know, we've had Charles has written an excellent response to my paper, and, you know, there's a debate here. But it's, David, I appreciate the fact you took the other point, that you've got to construct it from the moments of brutality. They have to appear in your self-definition and your self-description if you want a robust policy. Now, this commits the cosmopolitical agent to a double obligation. First, to recognize the alterity or the difference of others without necessary agreement or even accommodation, but certainly to recognize that alterity, while at the same time representing the estranged and alienating aspects of one's own heim, which then renders the active agent unheimlich. She is neither homeless in history nor lost in translation. She is ethically and discursively and politically compelled to occupy an improper home, uncannily positioned on the borders of the reasons of state and indeed the rationality of community, like many of us. I mean, this is, I think, the real problem of the minority position, the inside being inside and outside one's society. Each person, as held rights, may have an equal interest in active agency and self-determination, and he's right. But the inequalities, brutalities, injustices, oppressions, and humiliations that determine the historical fate of overlapping communities of fate may only permit, sometimes, a dependent rather than self-determining form of agency or self-consciousness to emerge. And it may cast a distorting shadow across the mirror of self-reflection. My point here is that whereas David is absolutely right, and with him many others, to stress the importance of reconstituting a cosmopolitical history, looking at the brutalities of one's own history, the agent needs then to be something different than the self-reflective, self-determining. I think that's something I would like to talk about. Then that's where you begin to see, and you will see in a moment in Adrian Rich, a different kind of agent who is both an active agent, a political agent, and yet fundamentally split and displaced. And I think sometimes the social sciences do not make this contribute, do not see agency in the way in which, for instance, psychoanalysis sees it, or in the way in which a number of social theorists influenced by psychology or psychoanalysis see the problem of the agent. In fact, I think this is a distinction that Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition also makes when she makes the distinction between the subject and the agent. That there's a kind of profound indeterminacy sometimes in what the agent is. There are some lines in Rich's remarkably prescient and pertinent work. Now let me again move to the next phase to explore this issue of overlapping communities of fate and global vision. In Rich's remarkably prescient and pertinent work, An Atlas of the Difficult World, which performs the process of ceding some part of the sovereignty of the self and of national self-interest in order to establish something like a global solidarity. The poem that I read with you takes up this challenge of what I've called the double, identifying with the alterity of the other while calling up the most alienating, brutalizing moments of her own history. She takes up, that's the position from which she performs the poem. Her work, as you will see in a moment, I do not believe is a sentimental surrender or a philanthropic gesture to the rights of the other, nor is it, in my view, a ventriloquism of victimage, although it could be read that way at first. The poet works through the process of partializing the poetic person, splitting its first person authority, its agency, literally splitting, sundering its agency. The poetic meter and moral measure of the verse is maintained across a long history of rights and wrongs through a momentary equilibrium of voice. I see in the voice of this poem that Gramscian problem of the momentary equilibrium of globalization's transitional moment. And she ends with what she calls an ethic of unsatisfaction. Memory says, want to do the right thing? Don't count on me. I'm a canal in Europe where bodies are floating. I'm a mass grave. I'm that life that returns. I'm a table set with the room for the stranger. I'm a field with corners left for the landless. I'm a man-child praising God, he's a man. I'm a woman who sells for a boat ticket. I'm an immigrant tailor who says, a coat is not a piece of cloth only. I have dreamed of Zion. I've dreamed of world revolution. I'm a corpse dredged from a canal in Berlin, a river in Mississippi. I'm a woman standing with other women dressed in black on the streets of Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. I'm a woman standing in line for gas masks. I stand on a road in Ramallah with naked face, listening. I'm standing here in your poem, unsatisfied. The insistent repetition of the subject phrase, I am, I am, I am, as in some bleak counting song of a monstrous child of our times, makes audible a conflict on the borders of memory, narrativity, history, and agency. Historical memory, having borne witness to the past, to history's promises and betrayals, says, don't count on me to do the right thing. And yet it is the unreliability of the narratives of history and memory that forces the poet to take a stand as witness, as body, in the performative present tense. I am, a stark, simple repetition, like a nursery rhyme, a stuck record. Reminds me very much of the Palestinian notion of sumud, this whole movement of writers who say, we are here. We are not leaving, we are not moving, we are just here. And if the ground gets smaller under our feet, we are still here. It's that kind of moment, I think, in Rich. The long historical narratives of linear progress or cyclical evolution are stopped short. In the poet's espousal of the philosophy of the part that allows her to identify with various overlapping communities of fate, linkages through fragmentations. When historical memory fails public morality, is the compulsion to repeat the beating rhythm of death the only answer? Each line contains its own encrypted narrative in which the instability and silence of memory acts out its struggle for recognition. Rosa Luxemburg may be the corpse dredged from the Landwehr Canal in Berlin. Emmett Till is certainly the body in Mississippi. The immigrant tailor's plea, a coat is not a piece of cloth only, recalls, of course, Marx's use of the coat to expound his theory of value and commodities. It is the provocation of the poetic impulse to work the lapses of memory in this contingent present time again and again through repetition into a revision, a resignification of the historical record as it emerges into what Gramsci called the incubational laboratory of the global present. Rich struggles to find a way of establishing a narrative of human interest, in Hannah Arendt's sense of the term, where to discover interest, what lies in between these distinct and even disjunctive moments of speech and action, allows them to become affiliated with one another without being approached or appropriated by an overarching sublatory sense of the predictability and promise of human progress. The emphasis in the last line on standing. I am a woman standing in your poem, should not be lightly passed over. For this is a particular kind of political stance, the standing of citizenship as a measure of public good, as respect and recognition, the notion of standing upon which Judith Sklar wrote her marvelous book on American citizenship, Citizenship as Standing. Citizenship as standing, the posture, this sculptural posture of confronting, as standing and confronting, arises from the poet's insistence that as active citizens we must vigilantly guard against the state's strategies of exclusion and discrimination in the midst of its promises of formal equality and procedural democracy. As a woman whose effective elision from the polity becomes a negative condition for the empowerment of the male citizen, Rich now stands with those who have had a minoritarian history on a global scale. She provides us with what we might call a vision of a vernacular globalism, a minoritarian cultural front. What kind of collective agency, what form of ethical political community emerges then from Rich's vision of an unsatisfied global condition? It's the unsatisfied that sends you back to revision. Rich is performing a speech act that addresses, I believe, in another language, what we call intertemporal equity and intertemporal rights, which, as Richard Falk has written in his book on human rights, emerges with the increased intermixing of peoples of the world through various forms of transnational migration. The repeated phrase, I'm a table, a field, a man-child, a woman, an immigrant, does not seek to establish the sovereignty of a representative world subject. Nor can the unsatisfied rhythm of repetition strive to restore some pre-configured normative sense of the good or the just of the free as a simple, freestanding, autonomous principle. Poetry insists on constituting its own free verse, if I may be allowed a pun, as it courses contingently through the here and now of the performing verse, putting bit by bit together in constituting an ethical and political vision. I have dreamed of Zion, I have dreamed of world revolution on the streets of Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. I am standing here in your poem, unsatisfied. These final stanzas bring me to the end of my talk and bring to mind a particularly moving and pertinent passage from Edward Said's final work, Humanism and Democratic Criticism, which once again represents another global vision of community built on the basis of what, both historically and conceptually, he studied so much, the problem of transition. In this book, it's more clear than ever, because I think there was a side of Said which actually was more Lukacian, which wanted resolution. There was a side of Said, the Adornian, exilic side, which was actually very, found totalities very problematic. In this last work, that's the Said that speaks, the Said that thinks about transformation. This is the book where he's so regretful. In fact, talking about symphonies, one of the great quotes in one of his, I think one of the most meaningful things he says, you know, if you see the tragedy of Israel and Palestine together like a symphony, you see what great music could have been made and what horrific battle chants are actually present. I think this last book is in that sense coming to terms with that idea. These final stanzas bring to mind a particularly moving and pertinent passage from Said's final work, Humanism and Democratic Criticism, which represents what he called his contrapuntal worldly concerns. He used the word worldly, which he also, I think, got from Gramsci. He was very influenced by Gramsci. Like Rich, Said was a member of the community of the ethically and politically unsatisfied to the end, whose mission it was to uncover the complacencies and collusions of historical memory. Like Gramsci, by whom he was deeply influenced, Said's contrapuntal cultural critique was committed to what I earlier called, the phrase is mine, not Gramsci's, his global philology. Historical fact cannot have strictly defined national boundaries, but that history is always world history, and that particular histories exist only within the frame of world history. The relevance of the Saidian sentiments I shall now read will not be lost on you, I hope, after listening to my talk today. And I quote, "Always and constantly the undocumented turbulence of unsettled and unhoused exiles, immigrants, itinerant or captive populations, for whom no document, no adequate expression yet exists. Humanism, I strongly believe, must excavate the silences, the world of memory, of itinerant, barely surviving groups." I've just written two things. I've just written the new introduction to Fanon's Wretched of the Earth for the new translation, which is the new American translation, which has just appeared. It'll appear at the end of in a couple of months. And I've just edited a set of critical inquiry essays with the University of Chicago will bring out called Edward Said Continuing the Conversation. What struck me in doing these two projects together is that one, Said was a kind of give or take, a Palestinian nationalist with cosmopolitan interests. Fanon, deeply committed to violent revolution, although that was only part of his vision. Unfortunately, it was one that was so superimposed on the book by Sartre's preface, which I have come to think differently of now than when I first read it. Isn't it interesting that from their various revolutionary, nationalist, cosmopolitan, post-colonial backgrounds, both of them wrote last books where they espoused what they called a new humanism. A new humanism. Quite an interesting coming together. Of course, they both died having journeyed across the world a few hundred miles from each other, Said in New York and Fanon in Washington. The global humanist narrative of revisionary repetition has, I believe, a remarkable capacity for enduring and enunciating unsettled states of transition, moments when history seems to be in a hiatus, times at which the international humanist faith hesitates or loses hope. In repeatedly asking the question of the part, as I have been doing today, what to connect with how and how not, Rich and Gramsci both enlarge and transgress the civil society of the nation by confronting its self-regarding and self-enclosing sovereignty and opening it up to a new historical laboratory of global cosmopolitanism, or indeed global socialism. Repetition is a deliberative measure of ethical and political reflection that maintains tension rather than resolves it. It is a temporal register that I promised to explore with you at the start of this talk that regulates narrative movement. We make those connections that allow us to see the part and the whole. Said writes somewhere, that is the main thing, what to connect with, how and how not. I hope this evening, in making visible the complex and conflictual relations of part and whole, repetition, I have shown you how repetition articulates a movement that exists between the space of words and the social world. The narrative of international critique, in its humanist and socialist mode, creates opportunities for oppositional writing. How do I form my chain of witnesses? From where do I get my interdependent systems of support that allow and enable the practices of identities other than those given by the flag or the national war or the monument? It is from the turbulence of wars, I believe, of occupations, segregations, and evictions, that I dare to hope that these unsettled energies of place and displacement may at some moment settle into a design for living with shared borders and intersected histories. And this returns me to my beginning, to that doorway of history whose door now flaps in the sharp winds of war, whose entryway is blocked by hate and fear. I leave you with this one thought, naive though it may sound. If oppression and destruction can tear down walls and destroy frontiers, then why can't those gates remain open, those spaces deterritorialized in times of peace. It is as if hostility brings us closer to our neighbors in a deadly embrace than hospitality ever can. Thank you.
Profound, difficult, incalculable presentation. And the music critics now have an opportunity to reflect on it with me. And we've only got 15, 20 minutes, so let's take your critical reflections in groups of four or five. Who would like to start? Well, can you, if you're going to move, before the questions, can you rapidly move? A question here? Yes, please.
Your final quote reminded me of Robert Frost. Good fences make good neighbors. I guess what I wanted to understand is more some of your criticisms, perhaps of David Hell's work. I'm interested to know about this construction of sort of a universal or global political consciousness, sort of the structural weaknesses, perhaps, in creating this global consciousness. Obviously, if we look at history, we see, you know, in the 1500s, the last Inca, Tupac Amaru, was killed. The genocide of the Incas. And now we are in 2004. 100,000 Iraqis, you know, civilians, not to mention soldiers and others, who've been involved in this war in Iraq. And yet we've got internet, we've got communications, we've got real-time communications. This global consciousness, which should have emerged as a result of these technological advances, as a result of some kind of awareness of what's going on in, you know, other locales, other temporal spaces. Where is it? What are the problems? And maybe David Held can also address this question. Thank you.
Well, let's take a few, is the cluster of reflections, and then.
This is a short question. I hope. Homi, could you say a little bit more about what you mean by the ethical? It's a phrase that you've used, or a word that you've used a lot during the talk, and how that stands alongside a perception of contingency and globalization and fragmentation in relation to agency. Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to give you more big questions. It's the nature. We're creating our own symphony here now. Please.
I was interested in what you had to say about Benjamin and photography and enlargement, but I wanted to pick up on that theme in relation to what people say about time and the cinema, which is also one of Benjamin's themes. And what tends to get argued about temporality, modernity, and the cinema is that there is no contingency outside systematicity. And so I was very struck by your focus on contingency and wondered if you did see some possibility of contingency outside global systematicity.
Anyone upstairs? Yes, please. And then just we'll take your question then, just perhaps one more, and then give you an opportunity.
I have just one question. In China, we have a saying, the most useless thing in the world is intellectual. So I'm just wondering, could you tell us what do you think is the role of intellectuals? Thank you.
Well, let me start with that.
We're not quite there. One last question.
I was very excited about what you mentioned about agency and psychoanalysis. And I was just wondering whether it was implicit in what you'd said, or maybe not, that we may think about an agency of the uncanny, particularly the uncanny understood psychoanalytically in terms of ambiguities of temporality, embodiment, doubling, so on and so forth.
Sorry, does this come again?
I'm just interested in what you would have to say about the idea of an agency of the uncanny.
And, Homi, just a thought from me. I mean, is a concept of agency as self-reflective and self-determining necessarily contradictory to one which is active yet split and displaced? I mean, I am not entirely convinced that if you take that theme, your theme, seriously, you are very far away from a concern with self-reflection, self-determination. It's just that you characterize its capacities differently. And I wonder what you think at the end of the day, the difference, the political upshot of this different way of characterizing agency. I mean, so I suppose I'm asking you, are they as oppositional as you suggest? And B, if they are, what is it? What is the political essence of that?
So we have
six questions, at least.
Agency, cinema, a Chinese urban myth about intellectuals, genocide, the Incas. I mean, this is an amazing crowd. Congratulations. let me start at the end and then work my way. The term I used when I talked about suggesting that there would have to be when I suggested two different versions of agency, evoking much more my sense of fragmentations or the splitting of the subject, the place of the unconscious, the use of what I call the dependent subject rather than sovereign subject, and so on. The word I used, David, was not that the one should replace the other, which is, I think, a mistake often made by people like myself who are interested in these issues, but it was to extend. Now, what may happen, what foundational ideas that, or what foundational issues in your notion of agency may have to be rethought in terms of mine.
I got that.
Is, right? Is,
yeah,
is,
I got that.
Is the issue. So I think, sorry. You want me to move on to the next one?
I got the implication.
So it seems to me that, for instance, unconscious motivations, the way in which people are not in a position to be self-reflective in their own interests, the way in which different kinds of networks of support might be required in order to make collective agency emerge. And so I think this would have an institutional implication too. The way in which those who have been violated can sometimes find their agency perversely through violation themselves and through violence. You know, these are the perversions and vicissitudes that I think we need to feed in to the model, and that would then have an impact on the whole question of ethicality, I think. And I think what I was suggesting, Roger, to go to you, I'm going to try to do this. What I think I'm suggesting is that first of all, for the ethical, one of the requirements of the ethical is not simply the subject in itself, but the subject and representation, the subject as representation. But I think that's an important issue. Secondly, I think the whole question of normativity, whether there is the point of tension within contradictory constructions of the normative. So that in a sense the temporality of the ethical is not settled. And I don't know whether in this paper I've just written something else where I said, you know, is the universal something you start with? Or is the universal something you work out? And on the other hand, you take an ethical position against moral statements by international bodies about universalism when, you know, something is established as a universal principle. And then, of course, so-and-so is not universal enough, and so-and-so is not human enough, and this doesn't count, and that doesn't count. So you begin, I mean, in the work I've been doing on some cultural rights issues, if you read the travaux préparatoires, which go into the formulating of the covenant or of the act, it's full of exclusions, you know, who actually belongs and who doesn't belong. So I think that the ethical allows you to raise the flux, the contingency of decision making and judgment within the institutions of normativity. Does that answer the question? Let me go to the from there. We're generally on the issue of agency here. So let me take up the uncanny issue. I think I've partly answered it in response to David's question. And the reason that I find the idea of the uncanny, I linked it to the position of the minority, neither inside nor outside. This is an idea that of the uncanny nature of minoritization, which really I've sort of developed through some work I've done on segregation and W.E.B. Du Bois's work. And it seems to me that an element of the uncanny that feeds into the question of agency is the issues, the psychoanalytic issue of melancholia. The melancholic subject, you know, Freud says that the melancholic subject is a subject who complains about his or her condition, who complains about his or her condition, but who is stopped at the point of plaint and cannot get beyond that. It seems to me that there is much to be said about the way in which that those kinds of affects, shame and melancholia as parts of citizenship, again require some way of extending the notion of self-reflexivity and adding to it. I mean, you can see how, for instance, in regimes of shaming now, it's perfectly good the way in which they're thought about in a completely public discourse, but the psychic dimensions of the experience, the affective dimensions, are not often engaged with. This is why I was interested in not simply in the exclusion of the minority subject, but in this unhomedness of the minority, this unheimlich. You protest because you belong. You don't protest because you are presented, you know, you're represented as an internal enemy, you know, an enemy of the state. You protest because you are cathected. It's that tension that I wanted to. Does that? Right. Let's go to China. The happy condition, of course, is that when I was in China, all I met were intellectuals. So hungry were they. It's never happened to me before that I hardly would give a speech and they would come and say, we need it to translate for our intellectual communities. People would literally take the speech out of your hand and say, we have to translate. You say, hang on, you're not going to talk to my publisher, you can't do this. So I actually found and find that intellectuals in China, that there's a great fervor of intellectual engagement in China. I mean, you know, we always thought Mao was an intellectual. We didn't know much of all the other stuff he was doing, but when we were young, we thought we read him on Contradiction. So I think I would be happier if I knew what China and who China and which China you spoke about, rather than say the Chinese thing, intellectuals. You know, this may be an amusing barroom phrase, or it may be something that comes out of the mouth of some dictator. I don't know. But I until I know what the location of that statement is, who makes that speech act, what is to be gained by it, what its strategy is, all I can say in a kind of dumb, empirical way is that it wasn't true of my experience. Let me get to the question of, so we've done the ethical, the first question. Well, whoever said technology should educate people out of their cruelty? Whoever said knowledge educates people out of racism? Whoever said? I mean, you know, Enoch Powell wrote poems, hymns to the beauties of India. hymns to, I think India was his particular soft spot. At the same time, as he was fomenting the worst trouble of its time, and I completely feel with you in your repetition. I am, I am, I am. I heard you sort of saying that in your testimony. I feel with you because, in a sense, we do feel we can educate people out of racism. I don't think that means that you should not educate people, but I am saying that at certain moments, even the supposed establishment of progressive, modernist, progressive, enlightened perspectives don't work. I mean, let me just give you an example. When did the current phase of Hindu nationalism start? It started with the liberalization of the markets. I'm not making some kind of, you know, boneheaded one-on-one issue, but it started at the point at which a lot of Hindu nationalists today will say, and I've heard them say on television, we are modern, secular, we are, you know, Hinduism is a cultural affiliation. We are not the, and yet, of course, we know what the RSS do and we know what effects there are. You know, let me give you just one example from the media. One of the events, and I do say it was a national historical event which created this, what we call the saffron wave in Indian politics, was a new film of the Ramayana. I think there were two, one of the Ramayana and one of the Mahabharata, you know, the great epics. These new video films were made with all the latest technologies and the latest camera actions. You know, there were camera movements and folk. I mean, modern technology produced that image of the arcade. And it's often this collusion, and those films were really the mustering, gathering forces for a lot of this opinion. I mean, I remember Time magazine did an article saying, if you want to call anybody in India, don't call them on, I don't know, whenever it was, Tuesday evening between 7 and 9, because they will all be watching this. It was, you know, people all watched it. And it did create a huge fervor about, you know, return to Hinduism. People have attributed its indirect effect, of course, to the Babri Masjid, you know, pulling down of the Ayodhya Mosque, which really ignited huge communal, intercommunal strife. So I think that it's one of the paradoxes we live with, one of the great constitutive contingencies of our time, that although we cannot stop the process of education, the process of civic consciousness, the process of citizenship, there will be times when, in fact, it breaks down. And that's what I think we have to somehow be prepared for, but also focus on.
We're almost out of time. Two or three one-sentence reflections? Anyone got a sentence they need to utter? Yes. We're watching you. No semicolons. Yes. Just zoom.
Thank you for your talk. Edward Said used to say that, you know, when he used to talk about Israel-Palestinian conflict, he used to say that, you know, how the main problem is that people don't realize that victims of history can victimize others. What is it about history that makes us, we living, what is it about us that when we live in different spaces and different locations that we see history in such an absurd way?
Sorry, you have to say, what do you mean by absurd? That in different locations we see history in
absurd to certain people, but not to them, in the sense that there's no reciprocity or acceptance of history.
Right, my quick question touches upon all the three questions on ethical, on intellectuals, and intellectuals' role in the world. If we present global world as an orchestra, as your analogy of orchestra, David's view, in my interpretation of orchestra, he looks into the dynamics within the orchestra, global orchestra. You look into enlarged equilibrium of how actually the picture is.
Yeah.
My question is, are you being evasive in actually projecting the quality of the orchestra itself? Once you have the picture, or one part of these parts of the picture, of the momentarily equilibrium, as you call it, wouldn't you then be in the position of describing what parts are? Like, Edward Said used to do or Fanon used to do. They were actually prescribing as how not only to interpret those parts of the world, but also how to actually transmit or to change. I haven't felt that you are prescribing something in this regard.
Thank you. Up there, finally.
Where does imperialism fit in your discourse about global visions?
All right, one, well, allow you one tiny sentence.
Any thought on human rights?
I thought yes. Too many thoughts on human rights.
Okay, finally, let me ask you another one thing. I mean, when listening to you just now at the end, you know, reflecting on what we need to draw from the darkness, from the disorder, from the vulnerable, from the margins, and so on, I was thinking for a moment about Hobbes's characterization of the state of nature. Mm-hmm. And that drove Hobbes into a thought experiment in which he then concluded that fundamental liberal principles are the basis, the checks and limits, and the only checks and limits on this dark capacity of us all. Where is liberalism in your politics?
Again, let me start.
Similar to your question.
I heard them as two different kinds of questions, but let me respond. I'll respond to these two together.
You've got 2 minutes.
Well, liberalism is precisely where you put it. It is a fundamental assumption, and I think that my notion of the ethics of community, it's there. My notion of rights, it's there. My notion of individual freedoms, it's there. But what I'm interested in is the way in which, despite the fact that since Hobbes we have talked about these things, I'm interested in my friend in the corner there, who says, what happens and why do we, how do we account, how do we describe the fact that we know about these things? They're enshrined in our lives, they're enshrined in our institutions. We have 400 years history of them. I'm interested in how each time something else happens, other things come in. And despite the fact that we have them, I don't doubt for a minute that they're foundational. In fact, my whole paper is based on that. But what I'm interested in is showing the relation between these anomalous, sometimes incommensurable issues that also happen in the life of liberalism. Does that... Okay, let me come to your question. You're absolutely right. I'm interested when you take a question like time and then you look at it at two different kinds of theories. First of all, yes, I am interested in something that you might call the big picture, the conceptual big picture, more than, say, somebody like Said was. And indeed, now that I work I've just done a lot of work on Fanon, even in a funny way, more than Fanon. But that's not the issue. The issue is that I'm interested in moving from that into very specific issues about the dynamics of the orchestra. That is why, having set up what I did, I moved into two particular issues that I felt I was very close to with David. But I mean, I wouldn't have chosen the Adrian Rich if, you know, except for that last line where we, you know, if we have to accept the brutality of our own history to create the new polity. So I think you're absolutely right. David systematically wants to describe the whole orchestra. I want to describe in my own wayward fashion something about the underlying conceptuality of this situation and then move and show its implications for specific elements, you know, the cello section and how that should be positioned and what its dynamic should be. That's, I think, the different working model. And the tension between, in a way, the part and the part is what I'm interested in. Does that deal with your question?
Well, the second part, not. The second part...
Why don't I prescribe some solution?
Well, it's a logical conclusion once you try to explain something. And if you base your conceptualization on Fanon, on Edward Said, on Gramsci, it's that conceptualization actually has got the tradition of changing things, rather, on top of that actual interpretation.
But why am I not suggesting that there should be a change? Why am I not suggesting that the notion of agency needs to be changed? Why am I not suggesting, for instance, that the notion of how we think about global interconnections and the temporality of global interconnections needs to be changed? These are all changes These are all pleas for a certain kind of transformation. Now, I have one more question about imperialism, where does imperialism? I'll only say this because time is brief. That preface to Wretched of the Earth, in fact, the argument there is as follows. Fanon's Wretched of the Earth everything that is written on it focuses on chapter one on violence. 90% of everything written about Wretched of the Earth is focused on violence. And on violence locks it into an anti-colonial dialect. But there is another voice in the book, I argue, where Fanon says, whatever, even if we get rid of our colonial masters, until the Cold War is over, and until we are not presented with what he called a univocal choice, choose socialism or choose capitalism, no third world country will be free. So effectively, I've argued that you've got to read Wretched of the Earth proleptically, not only as if it was written in 61, but as if it was written in 89. And there I argue that some of the current problems of globalization, some of the current constructions of globalization, are the unfinished history of of decolonization, rather than the story about liberalization of markets, fall of the Soviet Union, and then the global. So I tie it in that way. Anything else?
Just for me to thank you for the concert.
Thank you.